Next up on This Week in Law, I'm Denise Howell, and I'm joined by Sarah Pearson, my co-host. Professor Meera Sundara Rajan joins us too, as well as Ken Suzanne. We're going to talk about whether the dancing baby case can help Google with its DMCA comment spam, more happy birthday decisions, the Batmobile is copyrighted, PETA piles on the monkey selfie case, and lots more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Sarah Pearson. Episode 321, recorded September 25th, 2015. Because we have a song. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Braintree. If you're working on a mobile app and searching for a simple payments solution, check out Braintree. With one simple integration, you can offer your customers every way to pay, period. To learn more and for your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free, go to braintreepayments.com/twill. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell. Thank you so much for joining us for this week's episode of This Week in Law, where we revel in our obscurity and embrace the dullness of taking super exciting copyright-related and technology-related stories, things that might even be funny in their own right. We've got quite a lot of those today, and try and make them as dull as possible by giving you all the legal details involved in their underpinnings. That's what my son tells me we do here on this show, so I'm just passing along that review. With me every week, helping make the fun and exciting dull and dismal for you. She's one of the least dull and dismal people I can imagine, is Sarah Pearson. She's Senior Counsel for Creative Commons. Hello, Sarah.
Hi, Denise.
Good to see you. Yes, my son and his buddy, actually, I don't know when they did this, but he told me this morning that they made a concerted effort to sit down and watch the show just to see what it is that I do on this thing every week. And he said, "Mom, we lasted 10 minutes. And I was impressed they got that far.
So, that's really funny. My three-year-old hasn't tried yet. So.
It might be helpful, you know, at nap time, et cetera. We're hoping that you, our audience, what we understand is that there are people who love to hear intelligent folks who really understand issues help them understand issues. I come away more educated and with a better appreciation, better ability to think about all these complicated issues every single time we do this show. And on conventional sort of broadcast programming, you don't get the chance to chat for a really long time with really smart people and let them say what's on their minds without having to cut off for a ton of commercial breaks or the fact that there's just a lot of programming that needs to come and gobble up your time. So we're very grateful that we get to do this. And we're extraordinarily grateful that we get amazing people to come on the show. This week is no exception. Joining us this week is Meera T. Sundara Rajan. She is definitely a Renaissance woman, a scholar, a professor in Glasgow, an intellectual property law expert, an author of a book on moral rights, which we will discuss in a bit here, and a concert pianist. It's wonderful to meet you, Meera.
Thank you so much. I'm not sure how I can live up to that introduction, but I'm delighted to be around this afternoon.
All right. We're thrilled to have you with us. And if you're watching the video along with us here and not just doing the audio, we're showing a lovely photo of Meera. And I don't think that her grand piano is actually going to endanger at all of crashing down on top of her. She's actually seated behind it at the traditional player's perspective there. We really wish that you could both be on the show with us and play a little. We're going to try and work that out logistically maybe next time.
Absolutely. Looking forward to that as well.
Also joining us is Ken Suzanne. Am I saying your name right? Is it Susan or Suzanne?
Ken Suzanne is my name. Mm-hmm.
Very good. He is a lawyer with Barnes and Thornburg in Minneapolis, Minnesota. He practices IP law. He's also the host of IP Fridays. Great to meet you, Ken.
Well, great to meet you as well. Really happy to be on the program and participate in today's discussion.
us as well. So the courts and the litigants out there in the world have been busy giving us no end of great stuff to talk about on the copyright technology law front this week. So we're going to go right there and get into it. I love it. Titus in IRC says, we drip intelligence like maple syrup on pancakes, Ms. Twill. And that's exactly right. Well, we try anyway. We'll drip whatever we can manage to pour on our pancakes. So let's get into it. First of all, we discussed a bit last week, starting with Dancing Babies, the Lens versus Universal case that had really just come down at that time. And I think our panel was all sort of still trying to take it all in. And we gave you the main takeaway from the case, which is that that takedown notices targeted at people who incidentally may have music in their videos that they post, which is what happened in the Lens case. There was music playing in the background that wasn't an intentional part of the work. It just happened to be there. Stephanie Lenz's children dancing away to Prince's Let's Go Crazy. Those sorts of videos, other kinds of, really all kinds of videos that might have some fair use argument to make as to copyrighted components of the work for which specific permission has not been given. It's going to be a new world for video services. The firing off of takedown notices is going to have to become a bit more restrained. It remains to be seen, you know, if they will come as fast and furious as we have become accustomed to them coming. But in the wake of this decision, the rights holders are going to have to be able to demonstrate that they've at least considered fair use before sending their reams and reams of takedown notices. How the devil's in the details, how that's going to get implemented, and that's what will remain to be seen in the wake of the decision. But it does stand to change the way things are done. I do think that takedown notices will become hopefully more reasonable. I mean, I think that's what the goal here is, that they're not just being thrown out there in an ill-considered way. There seems to be a lot of hand-wringing about the court making mention of the fact that, well, we think that you could, you know, we understand that many rights holders are under a very onerous burden of trying to police a huge catalog of works to which they hold the rights. And we do think that technology is your friend in some ways, that you can automate some of this process, at least the matching part and letting you know that it's something to pay attention to. But I think what the court was saying there is not necessarily, this is what Evan was alluding to last week, that you could come up with an algorithm that understands fair use. I think that would be a really tall order, but that you could at least do some of the preliminary footwork and then plug a human into the process and say, okay, now we have some candidates here that might well be fair use and we're going to have to do some further consideration. Do you come away with that feeling from the decision, Sarah?
You know, as I read the decision, I was waiting for them to say that after they talked about the importance of automated systems and just dealing with the breadth of copyright infringement online, I thought that they were then going to say, you know, as long as some chunk of those were then considered for fair use, like I don't know if there would be some way for, you could imagine an algorithm that flags, you know, however many, and then some chunk of those kind of fall into a category of potential fair use. I have no idea how that would be, how those would be determined, but then a human comes into it. But the court didn't actually say that. And so it was just kind of left a bit, I was just kind of left a bit confused about it. They kind of just say that, you know, an automated system seems like a reasonable approach, but they don't explain how that would ever take into account fair use. And so it was just hard to square, I thought, with the rest of the decision.
Yeah, there wasn't a whole lot of guidance given there. One specific thing the court brought up that is fairly easy for an automated system to deal with is the quantity of the work that is used. Mm-hmm. If you can tell that the entire song or a pretty high proportion of it is in there, maybe that would go into the fair use bucket for further consideration to see if it applies. Because that's one of the factors that militates against fair use. If you use the whole song or whatever we're talking about here, whatever the copyrighted work may be, then there's a slightly less strong argument for fair use. You still have to plug all the other factors in. Mira, I realize you're not here in the U.S. and might not be paying as close attention to new decisions from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals as we are, but I wonder if you've taken a look at this, and especially given your musical background, if you have any thoughts about Lenz versus Universal?
Well, I have, as you know, a very strong allegiance to the West Coast. And more importantly, I think in the area of copyright, everything is so global now. And we're often looking towards not only the U.S., but the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to provide us with some guidance on some of these sort of cutting edge issues. You know, here in Europe, they call it fair dealing, but there's a big debate going on about whether fair dealing, which is a slightly more specific way of dealing with the use of copyright works, should be moving towards a more general approach, you know, like fair use in the U.S. So this is very much the sort of issue that people like myself, who have an interest in both sides of the pond and in copyright law, would be looking at fairly closely. So definitely, yes, I've been following this. And, you know, it's such an interesting problem. I love the way you introduced it, actually, Denise, because you talked about reasonableness. And I think what we see in a situation like this is, you know, copyright at some level did at one time, and I think should appeal to reasonableness and common sense. And the problem is that we've gotten tied up in all sorts of theoretical or legalistic complexities about how these rules should be applied, and we forget about what they're supposed to do. And so, you know, for example, the issue you were just talking about with the algorithms and that Sarah was discussing as well. I mean, I too think that that's super confusing. And if you look at it from the point of view of the way all of this has worked in the past, you know, it's not just the quantity of something that's taken. It's a number of other things as well. It's the quality of what's taken. It's the purpose of the use. And it's a question of private and public divide as well. And I think that's where technology often really challenges us. You know, what is a private use and something that therefore should not be reached by the extension of copyright principles and restrictions versus what is a public use that is potentially something that should fall within the scope of copyright. So if only we could apply reasonableness to all of this, we might be able to find better ways of dealing with the problem. And to me, the dancing baby thing illustrates these problems just in such a clear way. You know, this is someone who's taken a home video. This clearly is something that falls within the realm of private use, and yet it's triggered and is essentially a cease and desist sort of action. So, you know, it's an emblematic case in a lot of ways. And what you can hope when you get a decision like this is that somehow it's taking us more towards reasonableness, you know, than where we have been in the recent past. But the problem is trying to sort out all of the threads of the different theories that are playing into this and just making it very complex from a purely legal point of view, if that makes sense.
Right. Ken, I'm sure you've been watching this and you have no doubt clients who are scrambling to figure out how you validly send takedown notices here. Yeah. Do you think there's a workable approach? I mean, I think I'm pretty comfortable advising clients. You know, they have a few more hurdles to jump over here, but I don't think That's it's right. insurmountable. Do you?
Yeah, I don't think it's insurmountable. I think that you really need to think hard and long about fair use before you fire off a takedown notice. You really have to look at the facts from all different angles, but I don't think it's going to serve as an obstacle for counsel. I'm also sort of intrigued by the automated takedown procedures. I haven't seen such software or that type of thing, but I can envision now, you know, are programmers thinking about this? What are they going to be doing? So they measure the amount of a song that's taken or a video that's taken. What types of things that can be quantitatively measured? Perhaps there'll be some new products on the market in the future to help companies and attorneys deal with these matters.
Yeah, I'm sure there are. And that it would be a little complicated, but as long as you had, you know, a firm enough grasp on what fair use was, you could plug in some other factors besides just the quantity of the work used, mm-hmm. or at least, you know, flag that two or three of these things make it look like this could be a fair use thing. It's not simply, you know, music playing in the background with a black screen and some text. It's yes. something more than that. And we're going to have to take a closer look. One really fascinating thing I saw right after this decision came out is it was published at Torrent Freak, and who noticed that over at Chilling Effects, where Google publishes all of the DMCA notices it receives, there are a whole slew of takedown notices that Google is posting that it has received that have nothing to do with copyright law and everything to do, if you've ever been a blogger and combated comment spam, it's that. It's people using the automated forms that they're not automated, but they're online. They're available to post. So comment spammers are actually so interested in getting their links out there that they will populate Google's form DMCA notices that people submit with links to Viagra or whatever it is they want you to go check out. And I think there are actually tens of thousands of these at Chilling Effects. So I just think it's fascinating, given the Ninth Circuit's now pronouncement that you may not just fire off a DMCA takedown notice without going through a fairly sophisticated legal analysis. Clearly, these run afoul of that rule, but whether Google can do anything about it is a whole different question. Do you have any thoughts on that, Sarah?
I mean, it is fascinating. I'm guessing that these are the types of people who don't care that they're breaking yet another law. I'm sure there mm-hmm. are other laws they're breaking with their spam flood. Anyway, so it might be hard to police. On the other hand, the internet has become amazingly, or internet companies have become amazingly adept at dealing with spam. So maybe this is just another, you know, another roadblock in the spam fight. And I imagine Google and others will figure out ways to deal with it. But
yes, I'm sure Google's algorithms have no problem determining if a DMCA notice is purely spam.
Right.
And putting it in the appropriate bucket. So some fun fallout from Babies Dancing to Prince. What is also something we need to update you on, big news this week, also from the Ninth Circuit, Ninth Circuit case, or are we still talking district court here? I'm confusing myself. The Happy Birthday case.
I think it's the district court, but I'm...
Right. Hold on, I'm pulling it up here. Yes, this is still on cross motions for summary judgment in the trial court. So we're not having any review of this yet. It's just the case that we've discussed before on the show, where Happy Birthday to You Productions and the documentary filmmaker behind it, Jennifer Nelson, I think is her name, filed a proactive lawsuit against Warner Chappell, claiming that Warner Chappell doesn't actually have a valid copyright on Happy Birthday, which it has been collecting royalties on for years. And so the parties have been duking this out in the trial court. They had cross motions for summary judgment pending. And the plaintiffs, the documentary filmmaker, has actually won a significant portion of their motion for summary judgment, and the court has found that Warner Chappell actually does not have a valid copyright on the song Happy Birthday. Now, you may think that we all get to put on our birthday party hats and eat cake at this point, but it is far from clear cut. This is the most convoluted set of facts and really something only a lawyer could love. And I'm not, but really we would get super boring and dull if we tried to go into all the details of this case with the three sisters and whether they assigned their rights and 1909 copyright acts. And it's just a mess, this case, a huge, huge mess. But I think the court concluding that, found that there actually is no copyright. It'll be interesting, really interesting, to see if, as argued in the complaint or prayed for in the complaint, Warner Chappell is now compelled by the court to disgorge the royalties it has been collecting over the years to people who have paid them. Mike Masnick at TechDirt has a great write-up of this. You can see it and everything else we discussed today over in our TagPacker links, tagpacker.com. User is This Week in Law. And Mike hits the nail on the head and says, well, it's out of copyright, but, you know, don't celebrate too much yet. It's maybe an orphan work, so you might not have as clear a copyright in the, you know, a right to use the song as you might otherwise have if it had been declared in the public domain, which is not what has happened here. But as a practical matter, then, it's probably effectively in the public domain. Sarah, other than, you know, not getting too deep in the weeds in this case, are you happy to see that the documentary filmmakers here and the various legal scholars who've been claiming for years that there's no way where Warner Chappell has a copyright in this song have been vindicated?
I am, yeah. I think it's a great result, but I think even for a copyright lawyer, it's just a dreadfully boring set of facts. Mm-hmm. I have to admit, I did not read the opinion. It's just so technical. I would have much preferred to see something, and I wondered actually if this was argued, whether or not the lyrics could possibly be deemed original. Because the fascinating thing about the case is it's not about the melody, it's about only the lyrics. And if you think about it, the Happy Birthday song lyrics are repeating Happy Birthday to You three times and then saying the person's Happy Birthday to the person's name. And it just is, you know, kind of mind-boggling to think that that is something that we consider original enough for copyright protection. So that would have been, you know, to me, a much more interesting and fun way to have the case decided. But nonetheless, it seems like this is a win for everyone. And I would also say that I think, you know, it's technically right that it's probably, or at least could be an orphan work. But as a practical matter, we have no evidence to think that anyone else has the copyright. So I think we're all probably pretty safe in singing Happy Birthday.
Right. There are portions of this case that are still going to go to trial, I think, in front of a jury. And the poor jury, I just pity these poor people. They're going to be asked to make factual findings going back to the 1800s, early 1900s, that could be really hard. And it's really just sort of anybody's guess at that point. But I think in order to resolve the case, they're going to ask the jury to make some determinations. Mira, any thoughts on Happy Birthday not being Warner Chappell's?
Well, again, I think this is one of those situations where this should be really obvious. And this is just where we're at in copyright matters, where we need to get into an extended litigation to establish, you know, a principle like this. So I guess I'm going back again to your point about reasonableness. You know, we've seen many cases in recent years, and this one is not even what I would call the most egregious or striking of them, but, you know, many cases where claims are being made about copyright that just don't seem to make sense. The Dancing Baby is a good example. Another one, if you've followed the Australian folk song, the Kookaburra song, and there was an allegation that Men at Work had copied this song and were violating a copyright in what is essentially an Australian folk song, you know, the musical group Men at Work. And, you know, we saw another film, a film copyright case in the U.S. involving a Woody Allen film, Midnight in Paris, where an actor had quoted a slightly modified version of a line from a Faulkner novel, and that became a case of copyright infringement. I mean, these things, for someone who's been working in copyright for a while, you have a gut instinct that tells you, come on, this has got to be fair use. And yet we're in situations where these points are being litigated. So thank goodness, at least, I guess I'm seconding what Sarah is saying, thank goodness that the courts come up with the right answers and don't hesitate in doing that. But it's still sort of strange that we have to get into so much complex
Did we lose her, Victor?
Yeah, it looks like it. I'll try to get her back on.
We're going to thank our first sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is Braintree, code for easy online payments. If you're a mobile app developer, check out Braintree. Braintree is the payment solution used by companies like Uber, Airbnb, Hotel Tonight, Living Social, and Munchery. Braintree scaled with these companies from early stage startups to the successful companies they are today. So Braintree can scale with your business too. Braintree has made the payment experiences in these apps seamless and magical. And now you can add a similar experience to your own app. With excellent customer service and simple integration, Braintree gets you ready to receive payments quickly. And Braintree's continuous support plus fast payouts means you'll be prepared as your company grows from your first dollar to your billionth. Braintree is helping solve the problem of mobile cart abandonment by offering a best-in-class mobile checkout experience. Check it out for yourself. Braintree gives you a full-stack payment solution, support for all payment types your customers might want. Start accepting PayPal, Apple Pay, Bitcoin, Venmo, cards, and more, all with a single integration across all platforms. With superior fraud protection, customer service, and fast payouts. To learn more and for your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free, go to BraintreePayments.com/Twill. Thank you so much, Braintree, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, we were talking about the happy birthday case. If we have Mira back with us.
Yes.
Hi, yes. Okay, good. Sorry, we had a little Skype glitch there. I wanted to ask you, Mira, since you've authored a book on moral rights and a really, what sounds like, I haven't read it yet, but a really interesting and full of good examples and stories book on moral rights. The happy birthday case, although figuring out the factual details for the purposes of making legal decisions is a bit hard, but the factual details are fascinating. And that's a reason why the filmmakers are making the movie about the Hill brother, or sorry, sisters, and how this song came to be and what happened next. But there has to be a moral rights component to all of this, doesn't there?
Well, there almost certainly is, because when you get into these situations, especially with works that become iconic, you're often then looking at circumstances where maybe the people who originally created the work would like to continue to be known as the work's creator. You're looking at situations where if someone produces a work that's valued, they want to make sure that the work is preserved in a valid form, you know, going down for future generations. So yes, definitely. In this case, you know, one of the interesting factual aspects, as you were saying, is that the song was composed by these two sisters back in the 19th century. And that's kind of a fun, colorful side to the whole thing that has emerged as part of the factual matrix here. So yes, absolutely.
But here in the U.S., we're not seeing the convoluted legal arguments made on these cross motions for summary judgment involving a moral rights claim, because our law doesn't work that way, except in very limited circumstances. Could you explain for our non-lawyer audience what a moral right is?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's actually quite easy to explain, because it tends to make intuitive sense to a lot of people. So a moral right just basically means that if you create something, so if you're the author of something like a song or a poem or another work of art, then you have a special interest in that work, and if you like, a special relationship with it as the creator. And moral rights basically give you a legal status as the author to do things to protect the work. And depending on how long they last after your time, you can allow someone else to do that on your behalf. So famous examples would include, I mean, from around the world, would include situations where, for example, works of sculpture might be on display in a place and they get damaged when they're moved. And what happens in that situation? Who's going to be able to intervene to protect the works from getting further damaged, or to allow them to have an opportunity to be repaired and restored? So usually there, the author's moral right of integrity, it's called, would allow the artist to step in and say, well, actually, my work has been damaged. I'd like an injunction to prevent further damage from occurring. I'd like to put certain obligations on the owner of the work to restore it to good condition. So that's one important moral right, the moral right of integrity, that allows you to preserve, to take action from a legal point of view under copyright laws. of different countries of the world to preserve a work in an integral state. And clearly that has a very important public interest implication because, you know, pretty much every artwork starts as a work of individual creation, but at some point in time, it becomes public property. It goes into the public domain. So one of the important purposes accomplished by something like the moral right of integrity is to keep the public domain and works of cultural heritage that will eventually belong to the public in good condition, basically mm-hmm. by empowering the artist to act on their behalf. So I guess integrity, and then the other main moral right or interest that's recognized in most countries is the right of attribution. So just if you create something, to be acknowledged as the author of that work. So very simple idea, actually.
And an idea that has more force of law in Europe than it does in the United States, which has some fairly limited circumstances where moral rights can be asserted, as opposed to somewhere like France that has a long history of enforcing moral rights. A good example of this you wrote up earlier this year involved Maya Angelou and the fact she appeared on a U.S. Postal Service stamp along a picture of her, her name, and a quote that she did not author, but one which is very associated with her because she loved it and said it a lot. Mm-hmm. She said, "A bird doesn't sing because it has an answer. It sings because it has a song." And that mm-hmm. quote was actually authored by Joan Walsh, England. Mm-hmm. So how would Miss England or her estate perhaps correct that one might make the mistake that Maya Angelou had said this quote when she did not?
Well, absolutely. I mean, this is such an interesting story to me. And in fact, your question is so generally interesting because, you know, when you think of the United States, in many ways, it's a cultural powerhouse. You know, there are so many important authors, artists, musicians, and so on that have built up the American culture over the decades and the centuries. And yet it's funny in this area of the law that aims to protect cultural works and creators of cultural works. The United States is actually very much behind pretty much every other country in the world. So you're absolutely right to notice European countries and France and so on, because they're usually considered to be at the origin of the moral rights idea. But in fact, all over the world, all over Asia, in most African countries, you have a recognition of the moral right of the creator of a work. So the United States is quite a loner in that regard. And again, a little bit strange in a country with such diversity and richness of cultural works. And this example of the misquote, if you like, that's attributed to the wrong person on the stamp is just such an interesting one because under most copyright laws of the world, it's actually something very simple to address. It is just a clear, really obvious case of misattribution. And both Miss Angelou and Miss England, the actual author of the words, would have a legal action open to them. Each one of them could go to court and say, in the one case, I wrote those words and therefore my name should be associated with them. Or in the other case, I didn't write those words and therefore I don't want my name there suggesting or stating that I'm the author who did. And it's just very simple. It's just like bringing a suit for copyright infringement. And the evidence that you need to offer in cases like that varies a bit across different countries. But again, there's nothing complicated about it. At the very least, you just have to show the misattribution, so the stamp itself. And in some countries, you also have a requirement that you'd have to show some damage to your reputation as the misattribution. But I don't think that's hard to show in a case like this. You know, clearly for the authors involved, they're being associated with words that they didn't write, or in the other case, not being associated with the words that she did write. And so the issue of reputation seems fairly clearly implicated in all of that.
So, Ken, I have never had a moral rights case come up in my practice, given the limited mm-hmm. scope of its availability here in the United States. I'm just curious, have you ever had that issue come up in a case or even as a tangential issue and legal principle involved in a larger case?
You know, I have not had a moral rights case. I think about the days when I was in law school, when I was in an art law course at NYU School of Law, and the professor introduced the topic to us, and I found it to be actually fascinating. But I have not had a case where that comes up. I would foresee probably if one was in an international litigation or that type of thing, you might have that come up from time to time. But I haven't seen this particular issue come up in my practice. I think about a few things, though, in that the postage stamp might be applied to packages that go into countries that do have moral rights. So I'm wondering. Yeah, so I'm wondering where, and Maya Angelou is known worldwide. So I'm wondering what will come of that? Because to me, that seems like another piece of the puzzle.
And absolutely. Can I just jump in and say, you know, of course, that we have some case law now, some of it American, that tries to tell us which law should apply in the cases of disputes like that, although it's far from settled. You know, so for example, if that package comes into France, is it going to be French law or American law that governs that principle? But the overall trend seems to be to say that it's going to be in the jurisdiction where the harm is asserted or where the harm occurs, I guess, in this case. It's kind of a strange thing even to articulate, but I guess the bottom line would be that French law could very well apply in a situation like that, which would open up, in this case, the U.S. Postal Service to potential liability. So I absolutely agree with that. And I also wanted to just comment that I'm not surprised to hear that you haven't had moral rights cases in your practice because, of course, it's confined to visual arts in the United States. So your art law class was the right place to hear about moral rights in the U.S. with the law known as the Visual Artists' Rights Act of 1990. But otherwise, you're pretty much without recourse in situations like this.
I see there's a question from Rever B. Mike on IRC, and he writes, does U.S. postage work in France? That's a good question. I think if you put U.S. Postal Service stamps on a letter with the right amount of money, currency, it would get there. I don't think necessarily you have to have an airmail stamp per se, but that's a good question. Mm-hmm.
No idea. Let's try it out. We'll find out if let's use Maya Angelou postage and see if someone in France decides to sue on her behalf. We do have a really interesting case to discuss this week where someone has decided to sue on another, well, it's not a person, but another living biological entity's behalf, and that is PETA. Of course, we have had many, many fun shows discussing the monkey selfie and the copyright office's take on the monkey selfie and how there is no copyright in a work taken by a monkey, according to the copyright office. PETA has decided that, well, they're just giving their opinion and we really want to try this out in the courts. So they've filed a lawsuit here in California. They are suing as a friend of Naruto the macaque and on the monkey's behalf, because as they explain in great length, Naruto cannot file a lawsuit on his own behalf. So they would like, well, I mean, if you read the Gizmodo piece that we have in our discussion points today, there's a lot of skepticism about whether this is all just grandstanding and another sort of publicity stunt on PETA's part. But there's no question that they have filed an actual lawsuit and seem determined to pursue it, claiming that the monkey, in fact, has a copyright in the images and is entitled to royalties from their use, and that that money should go to, it will be managed by PETA on Naruto's behalf. Should PETA get its way, and we'll go to animal conservation issues. Once again, bringing my son into the show for the second time today. He was asking me what we were going to talk about, and I told him how fun it is, this monkey selfie case. And he's like, right, that's really fun. But the monkey would probably want to use that money to buy a phone or something, maybe a selfie stick. So PETA making decisions on the monkey's behalf struck him the wrong way. Sarah, any thoughts about this PETA lawsuit? Do you think they'll carry it through and that we'll get a determination on it? Or is it just so that folks like us will be talking about it?
No, I don't think I would guess if I were the lawyer for, is it Slater? Is that the photographer's name? I would definitely be looking into the standard for Rule 11. I mean, it just seems like there are so many problems with this lawsuit. Like, why do they have standing to sue on behalf of a monkey? It sounds like there was a statute of limitations problem. And then, of course, the question of whether or not the monkey can really own copyright in a photo is pretty, it seemed before this, well settled. So I think it sounds like a publicity stunt without merit at all. So I would hope that there would be some sort of recourse if they are just frivolously, you know, filing a lawsuit to get publicity.
Right. And what Sarah is alluding to is the fact that you can't just go filing lawsuits willy-nilly, that there are some standards in place that require you to not just file specious and frivolous lawsuits. And if a court finds that you do, you can be made to pay fines. We've talked about other examples of folks on the show that have had to pay hefty, hefty fines for filing suits that courts thought that they shouldn't have to, should never have been brought. So that is an issue to be conscious of here. I'm trying to see who the counsel are. We've got, looks like, is that a law firm? It's Arell. No.
Arell and Manila.
Arell? Yeah. Arell and Manila filed this lawsuit? That's a big law firm. All righty then. I suppose this is how someone is getting their pro bono hours in. But that could be a big concern. Maybe Arell has deep enough pockets that they're not concerned about potential sanctions. Any thoughts, Ken?
What I think about is if the monkey is victorious and he's able to own that copyright and so on, what about other animals? What about other things that happen in the future? And will this be a precedential case? My personal view on it is I think it's a bit of a stretch. But I also agree with Sarah that often cases do have this publicity value. And things just keep going on and on. It'll be curious to see how the court comes down, if they are even able to, if it's not settled out of court.
All right. Mira, do you want to give us your take on monkeys and PETA and possibly elephants who paint, who folks in the IRC are concerned about? Because obviously if PETA is successful here, there are other animals, I'm sure, who will have lawsuits brought on their behalf.
Well, I completely agree with both Sarah and Ken with their comments so far. And I think this is just so fascinating from several points of view. I mean, as Ken was saying, we're seeing a really interesting trend happening because of technology and all of the things that are happening in technology. So you might not think that animals sound like technology at first hearing, but then when you think about it, the whole idea of non-human authorship, you know, we've already started to recognize that in copyright law. You know, we recognize such things as computer-generated works, for example, and you just think about all of the things that are happening with artificial intelligence and so on, and now a lot of the text that we read in newspapers, for example, is actually generated by algorithms. So this kind of line between the human being and the machine as far as creating works goes is increasingly blurred. And how is copyright going to deal with that, I think, is an interesting question. And the initial approach, at least, has not been to exclude non-human authorship. Instead, it's been to recognize non-human authorship as a category and then try to define limits for that category going forward, an exercise that hasn't gone very far yet and may or may not be very successful as we get more and more deeply into new technologies that can create things. So I guess if you can compare that a bit to the animal scenario, it's not, you know, by any means impossible to envision a situation where copyright law would recognize animal authorship just as a matter of legal principle. So again, not talking here about reasonableness or common sense or, you know, even public policy, but just in terms of legal doctrine. And I think maybe I'll just add one more comment. What's disturbing about that for me you know, clearly in this case, it's actually sort of a good thing that's happened. As Sarah was saying, it's an opportunity for a public interest organization to draw attention to the issue of animal welfare. So I think that kind of gives us a warm feeling about this particular issue. But on the other hand, when you think about potential owners of copyright works exploiting those who create them, you know, whether it's animals or frankly human beings, you know, then we're starting to get into more disturbing territory and probably something that we really shouldn't in any way be supporting or facilitating into the future. That's part of the problem that's gotten us to where we are now with the so-called copyright wars.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, it will be interesting to see what happens with this one and if Irelin Manella and the other lawyers involved in bringing it do get slapped on the wrist or worse by the court. They're in the same jurisdiction, at least one of the jurisdictions that ripped into the Prenda Law lawyers for copyright trolling. This is a slightly different situation, but still, if you're going to file a lawsuit, you do have to comply with the law. So we'll keep an eye on that and see how Naruto does with his suit on his behalf. We'll go ahead and make our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. Naruto wants a phone. If you are listening to this show for continuing legal or other professional education credit, we put these phrases into the show so that you can demonstrate that you watched or listened to anyone who needs to have proof of that. So if you'd like more information about that, go to wiki.twit.tv. Find our page there, This Week in Law, and at least in the United States, we've given you a breakdown of the various jurisdictions and links to forms and things if you'd like to submit in your jurisdiction for credit for listening to the show. We hope that you will. All right, let's move on. This is bad news for anyone who wants their own Batmobile. It's about to get more expensive for you to have one because the Ninth Circuit... we're talking a lot about the Ninth Circuit today, has ruled this week that someone who was making custom Batmobile cars here in Southern California, in Temecula, was actually violating DC Comics copyright in that character in order to do so. The Batmobile has been elevated by the Ninth Circuit to the status of a copyrightable character, not just a functional vehicle that was part of the comic books and the shows. And so every time now that someone represents or uses the image or recreates the Batmobile, expect to have DC jumping all over you for royalties in the character. Sarah, did you have to cancel your order?
No, and I guess I'm not particularly surprised by this. What I thought, one thing I thought was really interesting from the, I haven't read the opinion yet, but from just the article that's in the show notes, was talking about how even though DC Comics didn't actually own the TV show or the film, they, because they owned the original comics, even if the replica Batmobiles were actually made by, in reference to the film or TV show, they were still indirect copies of the underlying work owned by DC Comics. And to me, that was interesting because it is kind of similar. And I want to do more thinking about this. So anyone should speak up if I'm speaking out of turn. But I was thinking about it from the context of 3D printing. And when you have a copyright in... a design that's then implicated by the physical thing, and whether or not I've often thought about, we've been asked about this actually, Creative Commons has, whether or not it's possible to be implicating the copyright in the design without actually having seen it or having had, you know, physically copied the design, but your physical object replicates it or implicates the copyright in the original work just by, you know, by the way it appears. So to me, it was just, I started thinking about it, trying to, you know, apply that rule in other contexts, and 3D printing came to mind, and I'm wondering if it will have implications there, but I think it's an interesting.
Yeah, it could. Case. This is fairly unique from that situation though, in that the copyright has to do not just with the design of the car, but with the fact that the Batmobile is almost like Batman himself or Robin, that it's an actual character.
The character, that's true.
Yeah, developed by DC Comics. So I think that that would be some small distinction between, you know, anything that you might find on Thingiverse. But of course, if we're 3D printing the Batmobile, then you're right in the same category. Ken, any thoughts?
Well, I think the idea of the car as a character is what's really a central piece of this, that the car has taken on so many different attributes. The shape of the fenders and the other things that you see reminds me of sort of a trade dress type of argument. All the various things put together, if you look at that coming down the street, you'll probably say that's the Batmobile. And as a result, it has sort of garnered this character like quality, which I think weighed in the favor of DC Comics here.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there we go. A bunch of 3D printed Batmobiles right there.
Oh boy!
On screen for those of you watching the video. Mira, do you want to add anything to our Batmobile discussion here?
Oh yeah. Well, I was just thinking that I agree with Ken on that very much, and it's one of those interesting questions where which happens actually surprisingly frequently, where there's an apparent copyright problem that can actually be much better understood by looking at it from a trademark point of view, perhaps because trademark principles just tend to be so much more practical and less doctrine driven, when compared to copyright. And clearly it's the identifiability, the originality, or you might even say the attribution of the characteristics to the work that really could even potentially define this as a problem of copying at all. Mm-hmm. So
I love it. You're bringing in the moral rights here.
Why not?
The moral, the moral rights in, well, it's certainly a visual work, but slightly not a painting, at least a painting you could drive around. So, Mira, I know you have to move on and get on with the rest of your evening. Thank you so much for joining us today. We've thoroughly enjoyed the discussion with you. Is there anything going on in Glasgow or with your scholarship or teaching that you want to let people know about before we bid adieu?
Well, if we have, thank you for that opportunity. And let me say also that it's been such a pleasure, and I've learned a lot from the comments, and thank you both for enlightening me as well, all of you, all three of you.
Thank you.
There are law students who are listening in, I actually direct a master's program called Intellectual Property in the Digital Economy, where we have entire courses dedicated to discussing things like copyright in 3D printing, moral rights in quotations on stamps, and so on. And I think we have really one of the most exciting master's programs in the world in this area. Perhaps one day I'll be able to tell you it is the most exciting, but that only happens if interesting students find their way to it. So if you have an interest in IP, please don't hesitate to look me up and get in touch. And we would just love to grow our program and include, above all, more American students, more North American students in it as well.
Yes.
Thank you.
That sounds amazingly fun. And if I were a law student, I would be jumping at the chance to go to Scotland and study IP.
Excellent.
I think that would be just a great way to spend a few years, especially with you, Mira. It's been such a pleasure getting to know you. We hope
you
enjoy your weekend and hope to speak with you again soon.
Thanks very much. I look forward to it and have a great rest of your program.
All right.
Thanks,
Thank
Mira.
You.
Bye.
All right. Let's see. Do we have more copyright to discuss before we move on? We do have one other interesting, just sort of a period on the sentence of a case we've discussed before. When it was filed, it's been resolved and it's on Forbes. So it takes a while to pull up. Let me try this one more time. They always have that splash screen that slows us down when we're looking at Forbes stories. But this was written up by Professor Goldman. It involves copyrights in photographs, and in particular, embarrassing photographs. This one was of Renan Katz, if I'm saying his name correctly. He was photographed, he owns a lot of real estate in addition to part of the Miami Heat basketball team. He was photographed at a basketball practice, a picture he didn't like so much. He doesn't look that goofy. His tongue's out, but it's not that bad a picture. But he really didn't like the picture, enough so that he went and purchased the copyrights from to the picture, acquired them, and now is trying to use those copyrights to get rid of the picture wherever it appears. And the court found that that is not okay, that you can't, as to borrow Eric's headline here, you can't buy a copyright just to bury it. And all under fair use principles, which were very important to the case. The court threw the case out, found that the uses of this picture, the particular use at issue in this case, was fair use because it was not commercial and various other of the fair use factors. So do you think this is the right decision, Sarah?
Yeah, I think it is. I'm actually kind of surprised, though, that the court granted attorney's fees to the defendant because, I mean, even though I actually agree with that on principle, but it just seems pretty harsh considering he actually, it sounded like, if I read it right, he actually did validly have the copyright transferred to him.
Right.
So there wasn't actually a question of misusing copyright in a technical way. It was misusing it from the purpose of copyright way and tech, you know, typically or in many circumstances, courts don't particularly care as much about that, the purpose of copyright, at least to the extent of actually, you know, granting attorney's fees for filing the case at all. That it's just surprising to me. I'm kind of, you know, happy about the result, but it just seems like pretty harsh.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this, you know, it's a good cautionary tale for lawyers out there when you get clients coming to you wanting to enforce copyright in something, not because you're worried about your work being misused, but for some other reason, like you would just rather that picture not be out there in the world, that's going to potentially be problematic for you for purposes of copyright reason. That's probably not the first thing that occurs to many lawyers when a client wanders into their office and says, I'd like to obtain the rights to this and then I'd like to stop its use.
Right.
It was no small attorney's fees and costs award either. It was $155,000. Ken, what do you think about this case?
Well, you know, I think what you have to look at is what was the purpose, the nature or purpose or motive of acquiring the rights and the copyright. And I agree with how the court came down here. Mm-hmm. I think the purpose here was to silence, or remove the use of this use. And I once we go towards censorship, that's where the red flags go up. And I think that was important for the court.
Yes. So another, you know, all sorts of good, cautionary tales for lawyers in this episode of This Week in Law, for clients who want to send takedowns and for clients who want to get their photos with their tongues protruding removed from the web. Just bear in mind, it might not be as straightforward as you think. I think that's our last copyright-related story for the day. So, Ken, you wanted to talk about drones. Shall we do that?
Yeah. Yeah, I've been getting involved recently with drones to the extent that there's a procedure now with the FAA to get what's called a 333 exemption, which allows you to fly a drone commercially, but you have to follow specific rules. In particular, you have to weigh less than 3 pounds, flown at an indicated speed, not exceeding 30 knots, no more than 300 feet above ground level, and you also have to be in the visual line of sight of the pilot in command. So there's a procedure to go about getting these exemptions. In fact, you can go onto the FAA website, faa.gov, and read all the petitions. They're almost granting them weekly, if not daily. And I think there's going to be a lot of new businesses coming down the pike, particularly in film, entertainment, real estate, agriculture. It's a big, big thing for farmers to use drones. So with that comes other things to consider, privacy issues and other things about how much will we allow the drone to cruise the skies, and what are the public policy implications and other things like that. And so I think you're going to be reading about this, hearing a lot about it, and you may even see a drone in the not too distant future delivering packages.
Yes, I wouldn't be surprised about that at all. And you're right, this is all public policy related concerns, and the FAA is attempting to make smart regulations about this. So we have some stories along those lines to go through, but I'm going to feel incomplete unless we play our bumper. There we go. Now I have closure. With the Pope visiting, it's interesting that the FAA got out in front of what would have been, I'm sure, drone-filled skies above various places that the Pope is poping around. But the FAA has declared wherever the Pope is to be a no-drone zone. That's a good thing, probably for security and safety reasons. Not such a good thing if you're a journalist or a hobbyist who just wanted to get some aerial footage of the Papa. Any thoughts on this one, Ken?
Well, I think that it's the right thing to do. I think you need to have some sort of control. If all these drones were cruising the skies while the Pope was en route or trying to get video, you can imagine paparazzi using it. I think you need to have that ban out there and have some sort of control. There are rules and regulations out there, and with respect to other times when the Pope is not here. But for events like this, where so much of it, everyone wants to get a glimpse and see, I think it's a good thing to have these rules in place from time to time.
Right. The NFL got one of the exemptions that you've been talking about, Ken.
Yep, that's right.
Although it's quite limited and doesn't allow them to film over packed stadiums. And the FAA is going to be looking hard at whether the NFL is using their exemption within its narrow scope. I think that this is one where the NFL just went ahead and has been using drones, I believe. I mean, I see them flying around at football games, and I see the aerial coverage they're providing. So I think they've been going ahead and asking for forgiveness, not permission. And now they've gotten the permission, they might find their use more curtailed than what they've been doing. Do you know more about this?
Yeah, so with that, you know, they're limited to shooting films, documentaries, and other television-type productions, but not during the game days, not during practice. There is an eye towards safety. So, you know, with that in mind, they're sort of within a carve-out of sorts of what they can and cannot do. And I think as long as they follow that, the drones will be great for them in enhancing their capabilities of taking photographs and pictures from a different vantage point, because that's really what it's all about, a different vantage point, seeing things like you just haven't seen every day. And the drones really do have that capability. It's really another thing with respect to real estate. I can tell you that a lot of real estate companies are looking at drones to take photographs, aerial views of properties, so that they can present the properties to prospective buyers and show buyers a different angle that they ordinarily would not get from the ground.
Mm-hmm. Here in California, our governor, Jerry Brown, just vetoed a law that he thought was putting unreasonable restrictions on the flights of unmanned aircraft systems. So I think this is probably playing out in almost all the states, that the legislatures are trying to put together rules, the FAA is trying to put together federal rules of what kinds of uses are going to be okay and what not. The proposed California law got knocked down, but I'm sure we'll see something else coming along. News organizations were not a fan of this law, so they're happy that it got pulled back. I'm sure they wish that they could have filmed the Pope with their drones too. So, I mean, it's going to be a continuous back and forth. Any thoughts in particular on the California law that did not pass?
I think that it was a good idea that it didn't pass because, you know, how is one going to measure how high that drone was over that person's property? You really have to get into specific mechanics. And I think it'd be very difficult to enforce this type of law if it went into effect. So, you know, I think it was the right move.
All right. Before we leave the policy front here, I just wanted to mention, since we've been following it on the show and there was some news that if you're an AT&T user, you might not know about yet because AT&T didn't tell anybody. But if you're reading tech news or watching our show, we're happy to fill you in. And that is that as part of its strategy to deal with the fact that the FTC does not like what it's been doing with its grandfathered unlimited data plans, it's bumped up the limit where before you were getting throttled after 5 gigabytes of data in one billing cycle. Now it's up to 22. So that's a significantly larger amount of data for you to use. It's still not unlimited without throttling, of course, but AT&T's hope is likely that 22 is generous enough that it's not going to get enough angry customers that might sue. I think it's underestimating that people get pretty riled up about this kind of thing. So I'm sure this isn't the end of the story, but if you are one of those early adopters who bought the very first iPhone when it first came out and AT&T was the only carrier and it came with that unlimited plan that you've been clinging to for dear life, you now have 22 gigabytes per billing cycle of data to use before you're going to get slowed down. So that seems like a good thing. Let's move on and talk about watches. This has been a big week in watches, and since it's wearable and watches are connecting us to our refrigerators and other things, we talk about it as part of the Internet of Things. So Pebble came out with its Pebble Time Round and a whole bunch of other Pebble watches to compete, well, further compete with the Apple Watch and Android Wear this week. Ken, this is something you've been following, the Watch Wars. Tell us why you're interested in it and your legal perspective on it.
Well, wearable tech to me is another thing that fascinates me. There's so many different gadgets and clothing items and jewelry and things that will carry brand names. I'm a trademark lawyer, so naturally I'm drawn to new technology and names that are used to identify these products. And so I see this as being an incredible wave as the years come forward on new products. And as a trademark lawyer, I have to keep my eyes open for that. In this case for Pebble, I think the fact that they're changing the shape, they're trying to appeal to a different audience, people whose wrists, smaller wrists, would accommodate that type of watch. A watch that's going to look different, won't be so sort of boxy or tech-like, but would be more sort of acceptable if you were going out for a night on the town. So I think you're going to see a lot more integration into mass culture and pop culture and in style and fashion for wearable tech. There'll be devices you can wear on your lapel to rings and other things that will be part of this grand, you know, Internet of Things. Everything talking to one another, sensing things. It really is not back to the future anymore. It's a new world, and so that really sparks my interest in connection with IP and protecting IP.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that the Internet of Things is finally getting to that level of penetration where, you know, people don't laugh anymore at refrigerators that have computer functionality built into them. Our 17-year-old refrigerator just died, and the one we're ordering to replace it is going to have an LCD screen. I have not yet determined what it does, if it's going to order wow. milk for me or if it's just going to give me news and weather. I kind of suspect the latter. But, you know, it'll be the first time I've ever had a refrigerator that in addition to ice and water on the door has a screen. So, you know, I think then that's just the way it comes. And you don't have to spec it out or anything. That's just how these things are being shipped. And I think the same is true, you know, with home automation, that if you're putting in a new HVAC system in your home, I'd be stunned if there are a lot of them out there that are the same old, just, you know, box thermostat on the wall and don't involve now a whole lot of smart and remote operation kind of features. So I definitely think that these wearables are, I agree with you, Ken, that the more they become attractive from a fashion standpoint, comfortable from a wearability standpoint, the more people will use them and the more legal issues there will be around what exactly these things that you have on, actually on your person all, a lot of the time are doing for you or with you. Sarah, any watch thoughts?
No, I was just thinking about, I have Internet of Things, I guess. I use a Fitbit Surge. Mm-hmm. And I, mm-hmm. I generally think it's a bit of a, it's kind of scary to think about all of the smart objects that we have and lots of, we don't even think about the data that's being collected and where it's going. And if you do think too much about it, I think it's easy to, at least if you're me, it's easy to kind of get a little bit freaked out. But not freaked out enough not to have the watch or, you know, whatever the convenient thing is. So it's just one of those, I don't know, it'll be interesting to see how it develops. But I think it's kind of a little bit scary.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like the Fitbit, you know, would you be unhappy getting along without it? Have you come to rely on it?
I do. I mean, so I work from home and I found it was really scary when I first got it. I found how little I moved because mm-hmm. I don't even walk to the car, you know, at lots of days. Well, you know, I maybe leave the house once. And so it was horrifying actually the first few days when I wore it, and was without, you know, trying to actively walk more. And so I found it's really kind of changed the way I work. I set it up to have an email sent to me, at 10:30 and 2:30 every day so that I remind myself to walk, take the dog out for a walk. And, it's actually really changed my behavior in a positive way. But, I guess I don't care as much about, it's very boxy and, you know, Ken was talking about how the Pebble watch is more fashionable. This one definitely is not, but I kind of just wear it for everything too anyway. But right. I really like it.
There we go. All right. Well, from watches to cars, Volkswagen's CEO has stepped down over the scandal about their using software to end run environmental requirements. And you had a really interesting article you found on this, Sarah, that it's in the New York Times, and it really highlights the fact that there's a difference in whether this kind of thing can happen if you're using proprietary software versus open source software. Can you expand on that for us?
Yeah. So the idea is that if this were open source software, it would never have happened because people would have been able to see that it was rigged. If it's proprietary, it's actually illegal, you know, under the DMCA to break into it and figure out how it works. So the thrust of the op-ed was that, you know, this is really a safety issue, the use of proprietary code. And I just thought that was really interesting. I hadn't, you know, when I first heard about the story, that was kind of the last thing that came to mind, but it makes sense. And to me, it's an interesting way to maybe have open source software gain a little bit more traction. I think in some ways, it's kind of easy to say, well, open source software doesn't matter as much to me if you're not a techie, because if you don't know how to tinker with the software, it's less relevant. But this is a way in which it's relevant to everyone, because even if you might not be able to tinker with it, someone can, and that actually can make us safer in a lot of ways. So I just thought it was, you know, an interesting spin on this story that's been all over the news.
It is. And I hadn't, I think I'd sort of thought in the background about it, but Eben Moglen is cited pretty extensively in this piece, who's the founder of the Software Freedom Law Center. He's been on FLOSS here on our network, and professor, a lawyer and technologist. And he points out that when we're talking about things that involve safety, airplanes, medical devices, elevators, and of course cars, we should be thinking about how to make sure that there are checks and balances on how they function. He's talking about elevators here. We can need elevators to be inspectable and require manufacturers of elevators to build them so they can be inspected, and that we need to be holding automakers to that kind of standard as well. Here, this was an EPA rather than a safety concern, but still you could see how it would carry over to other functions of the vehicle as well that have to be inspected and compliant. Any other thoughts on this, Sarah?
No, I don't think so.
All righty then. I think we need a second MCLE password, and we'll make it Buggy Bugs for those of you listening for continuing legal or other professional education credit. Winding up our show here, we always like to give you a tip of the week and a resource of the week. Our tip of the week comes to us courtesy of the story you might have seen this past week, where an individual named Ali Saleh was arrested following an FBI investigation into his attempts to join ISIS. And what the interesting bit about his arrest for our purposes is the fact that some of the evidence against him, some amassed in the FBI investigation, were some of his retweets. So if you don't think that a retweet could be held against you, think again. And he was retweeting people who were sympathetic with ISIS and saying, "I'm ready to die for the cause," and "war is necessary," and things like that. So without any comment retweeting those, the FBI went ahead and decided that, yes, what he was engaged in, and I'm sure there were other aspects of the investigation, but that those sorts of tweets could be the basis, among other things, of prosecuting him. So that is what's going on here. And as Kate Nibbs writes over at Gizmodo, in other words, maybe cool it on ironic retweets of state enemies would be our tip of the week that we'll adopt from Kate there. Sarah, are you concerned about the speech chilling ramifications of this? Or do you think people should be smart enough not to retweet their support of terrorist organizations?
Well, I think it's interesting because with the retweet, lots of people retweet things that they think are ridiculous. I see that all the time, actually. Mm-hmm. Joan Walsh, who we spoke about earlier, actually, in the context of the postage stamp, she's a mm-hmm. journalist who I follow on Twitter, and she's always retweeting these ridiculous things. And it's funny because it catches my eye, because I'm like, why, how does that show up in my feed? And then I realize that it's her retweeting some awful thing that somebody, she gets trolled a lot. So she'll, retweet these things that people say to her. So I think it's definitely not a given that something you're retweeting is something that you believe in. You might actually just be spreading the word about how ridiculous it is. So it is kind of an interesting thing to think about.
Right. And as Kate writes over at Gizmodo, the distinction, she points that out too, that people retweet pro-ISIS tweets for other reasons, that you might just be trying to highlight the ridiculousness or prevalence of something, and that the standard would be the police can't arrest you for retweeting something unless you have evidence that the intent behind the tweets signifies someone acting with criminal intent. So they actually drew connections from the tweets that might not be there, hopefully not for journalist Joan Walsh.
Right.
Our tip of the week, just in case you hadn't seen that, our resource of the week is twofold. It is hearkening back to Professor Mira telling people to go study IP law in Glasgow, a couple of resources for law students. One is a subreddit that is called The Law School. I'm sure there are lots of subreddits for law students, but I just happened to stumble upon this one. It looks like a good one, a space where law students can freely post the content they like, news, advice threads, memes, or meta discussion. I wish that when I had been in law school, there were good community organizations, means for people to get out of their own law school's bubble and interact with law students from around the country and around the world. And it seems like this subreddit might be a great opportunity for that. And then also, if you're a law student and you're interested in blogging, I heard from Adam T. Music, who is working with the ABA Law Student Division, and they're starting a new blog and they want contributors. So if you've are interested at all in blogging for the American Bar Association, you can contact Adam T. Music. The best way, I don't have his email, but he's on Twitter. So maybe just shoot him a response on Twitter. He is Music Adam T. on Twitter if you're looking to get in touch with him and possibly blog for the ABA. This has been a really fun show. Lots of great topics from Batmobiles to monkeys and dancing babies. How could we do much better than that? Ken, we're so thrilled that you've been able to join us. Tell us what's going on at your firm or in Minneapolis that you think people might not have heard about, but they should.
Well, we've just opened up a Dallas office, so we are expanding, and that's always a good thing to do. For myself personally, I've been working on a podcast for over a year called IP Fridays, and you can go to ipfridays.com to listen to all of our 30-plus episodes. We've had a lot of great people on. We're always looking for new topics, and it's a wonderful way for me as an attorney to keep current and to help spread and share my knowledge of developing IP subjects. We do cover wearable tech and drones and other trademark, copyright, and patent issues. My colleague, who I believe was on the show a number of weeks ago, your show, that is,
yes,
also works with me on IP Fridays. And so it's a great thing. We believe that we're one of very few of these types of programs worldwide. And we do actually have a worldwide listener base, and we're always looking to grow it.
Very cool. Thanks so much for joining us, Ken. Sarah,
thank
great
you.
To see you again.
Thank you. Lots of fun.
Hey, how's your Kickstarter going?
It's good. We are now in the process of, we just had people vote on who they wanted us to profile in the book. So we're in the process of kind of deciding who we're going to profile, which is kind of a big decision. It feels like we're writing the book before we do the research. So
<Yeah.
laughs> we'll probably announce that on Monday. So that's been a lot of the work, this week, but I'm excited to kind of dig in finally and start, you know, the meat of the work on the book.
Very cool. I'm glad that's going well. All right. Well, if you've joined us on Friday afternoon, that's when we record this show, much like Ken. We do an IP-related Friday, every Friday show, whenever we can be here anyway. And we do it at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. And that's when we suggest you join us live if you like to do that. It's very fun to jump into IRC and give us your thoughts on the show as it is unfolding in real time. And we literally could not do the show without our IRC group, who are always there to catch us when we fall and tell us things we forgot and help us look things up so that we're not wildly typing while doing the show. So we love having a live audience. We hope you can be part of it. But if you can't, don't worry at all, because if you go to twit.tv/twill, our whole archive of shows is there, and you can catch up on all our back episodes or any of them that you might like to see. And you can do it in all kinds of ways. If you like to watch YouTube, that's, you know, I'm held in my family to the standard of PewDiePie, and I'm afraid we will never, ever approach those sorts of numbers, but we do make the show available on YouTube, should that be an easy way for you to watch, and all other kinds of ways you can watch. If you're an iTunes person, if you like to watch on your computer, if you like to watch on TV via a Roku box, or many, many other ways, there at twit.tv/twill, you'll find out just exactly how it might be convenient for you to watch. And we're going to be back with you next week with a gaming law panel. We love doing those, focusing in on all the interesting issues around video games and esports. So stay tuned for that next week. We hope you can join us then. And until then, please take care. And we'll be back whenever, wherever, always.